This presentation is going to be on next generation user interfaces with Windows Presentation Foundation. My name is John Daniel Trask. I'm the co-founder of Mindscape. Now, Mindscape is a company that builds software products for other software developers. Primarily, a lot of our products are WPF components, so I hope that gives me some understanding of how WPF works and puts me in a place to present on this to you. I'm also an ASP.NET MVP, and here's my blog address. I'll be pushing the slides and content up onto there once I've finished doing these presentations in Auckland. There's my email address if you have any questions and would like me to answer them, just send them my way. Right, the agenda for this presentation is that we're going to be talking about user interfaces, user experience in general, what does next generation mean? Then we'll look at WPF and how you can build beautiful applications. And then, of course, we want to look at how WPF can be leveraged to build smarter applications and look at the things that aren't UI related that come as part of Windows Presentation Foundation. We then have a small piece on Silverlight 2 and the differences between WPF and Silverlight. Then we look at your next steps, what you can do after watching this presentation, and the future, where is user experience and user interface going in the coming years. So what this session isn't, is it's not about crazy stuff. So I don't know about you, but I've seen a fair few WPF presentations where you see a whole lot of things that you can't actually use yourself when building, say, line of business applications or the things that you're going to be building in a realistic sense. So as an example of this, I was having a hunt around on the internet and I found a reasonably cool little sample, which is the sort of thing I've seen a few times where you think, wow, that's cool, but I couldn't realistically see myself using it. Let's take a peek. Alright, there's this application called ClothText. Let's run that up. As you can see, it's a rather attractive kind of moving box. It's got a physics model there. And you can be thinking to yourself, well, I can't really see myself using this in a line of business application. But then, what if it was a text box? Well, just so happens this is a text box. Now, I think this is kind of cool. It is a fairly whizzy demo, but it's also something that's reasonably pointless to us as developers. It's nice to know we have this capability, but realistically, we're not going to be building applications using this kind of capability in the future. So, what do I mean by what is next generation UI? Well, one of the primary things that's starting to become more and more common is the demand for richer data visualization. This is where we can create beautiful visuals for end users to consume information with, and it's part of the reason why WPF is so flexible and capable in rendering things like the completely floaty version of the text box that we just saw. We are finding that we're ending up with applications that have a lot more data in them. Displaying things in a data table, for example, is becoming less and less of an attractive proposition because it's difficult to actually identify trends and break up that information in an easy to consume fashion. We're starting to find that it's beneficial to build applications using familiar end-user metaphors. So what do I mean by that? I mean that if we're building applications, we're software developers, we tend to understand how software tends to work and the common idioms that we would expect to see within applications. However, end-users, they don't necessarily have that same domain expertise and they may be looking at things from the way they normally work. So take a medical officer or a nurse or a doctor, and they have those things that hang off the end of the beds with your medical records at the current state for what's wrong with you. You know, they pick that up, they flick through it, it's got the data in there. They know how to consume that information. If we could build an application for health professionals that mimicked that same layout, perhaps we could visualize the page turning effect, but yet also pump in some extra information like a heartbeat monitor and things like that, we're going to find that those end users are much more efficient at picking up and understanding that application. And I've got here next wave of HCI is about to hit. Well, HCI stands for human-computer interaction. Now, human-computer interaction has been a reasonably hot topic in universities for some time, and despite the fact that we often refer to students as not being in the real world, the real world does take a lot from what academic study and start to apply that in the future. We're starting to see that, in my point of view, filtering out into the real world. We're starting to see people caring a little bit more about HCI concerns, and that's reflected in things like the user metaphors example that I just had. So why has it taken until now for this to really become appropriate to think about? One is computing power. I mean, most computers these days come with a GPU or graphics card that's hugely powerful. A lot of business machines actually come with these, and of course, they're not, business machines aren't running games, so this computing power is sitting there idle. The same with CPUs. CPUs are massively powerful these days. And further to this, WPF is now a fairly mature framework. It's been out for some time, but you don't tend to want to stake the farm on the first version of a product, and WPF has come quite far. As a sign of this, for example, Microsoft has built Expression Blend completely with WPF from the ground up. So if you're looking for a great modern desktop example of an application using WPF, just check out Expression Blend. And further down the track, Microsoft are looking to replace the UI of Visual Studio 2010 with a complete WPF user interface. This is a screenshot I found on the net. I'm not sure if it's actually going to be how it looks in the end, but I think that looks kind of styly. So, how does UI and user experience fit together? Well, clearly, UI is only part of the user experience. The user experience takes into account how a user, for example, manages the input into the system, how they feel about using it, how intuitive it feels, things like that, and a lot more. Businesses are starting to understand the benefits of user experience. I'll come back to that example about health professionals. Well, if a business is going to undertake building an application for their internal staff, they don't necessarily want to build something where they fear that the staff may reject it or not use it. And I'm sure we've all seen applications where, with the best of intent, a customer has come to us, we've built an application, tried to engage the users, and they've kind of rejected it. Change is always something that's hard to bring about, so businesses are seeing that as a safe bet is to start applying a better user experience focus. This is a quote that I remember from my human-computer interaction classes back at university, which is, "The interface is the system." Now, as software developers, we tend to think a lot in code, but at the end of the day, the user has to work with the interface itself. They don't care that you've got some funky, cool, anonymous delegate stuff going on, or that you're using thread pools all over the place. If the user interface is not intuitive and easy to use, they're going to reject the system outright. They're not going to enjoy using it, and you'll get complaints. So, what is WPF? WPF is an advanced GPU accelerated UI framework. GPU, again, being a graphics card, so it means that we can sit there and actually accelerate things. We're not rendering things with software. Software rendering is what we used to have with GDI and the such, and it suffers from some performance implications there. We can't create really rich experiences using just a software approach. It's also a completely vector-based framework. What I mean by that is images and that, well, the way that controls look aren't bitmapped. That means that when they resize, they can smoothly resize. You'll all be aware that when you drag an image, for example, and you resize it, that it becomes quite jaggedy and it loses a lot of fidelity. With vector-based things, when you resize them, because you're using things like path information that just gives descriptions of how things should look, for example, a curve that is 3% of the total size will can be redrawn smoothly as it's resized. We use a XAML as a language for creating the user interfaces. This is a declarative XML markup for the UI, and the reason for XAML existing is that it allows a clean separation of concerns between the view and the application code itself. This has some additional benefits in terms of how your work environment is structured. For example, you may have a designer who's a fantastic designer, and they can sit down and work with the XAML themselves and then provide that back to the developer, but they can work in parallel. The developer can sit there writing code using a very primitive makeup of the user interface, and then closer to the end of the project, reintegrate the user interface, the XAML files back in over the top, and still have everything work nicely because of that clean separation of concerns. There's also a lot of code in WPF around application infrastructure, so we're going to be looking at that as part of the second half of this talk. But WPF is much more than just a user interface system. You've got sound capabilities, input. Now, by input, I mean we clearly expect mouse and keyboard, but there's also stylus support. WPF 4 is going to have things relating to touch capabilities. There's also the ability to create things like mouse gestures in your application. So, for example, if I move my mouse in a circle, that might be the way of indicating to the application to exit. We also have full video capabilities and, like I mentioned, the application infrastructure there for enabling this clean separation of concerns. This is an image that I like to use when describing WPF. It's about the idea that 80% of an iceberg in the sea is actually underwater and can't be seen. And I would say that most people probably see WPF as the bit sticking out of the water, and the application infrastructure and all the other capabilities of WPF aren't really obvious to most people. The challenge this is that when you first build a WPF application, it can be a little daunting. It is a very large framework. It will take you some time to learn, and of course, you will find that you bring a lot of the ideas that you've been used to working with WinForms across to WPF, and find that it's a real struggle to actually apply those, or that your application doesn't feel as elegant as it could be. Unfortunately, this is just a necessary evil of moving from one framework to another, but I strongly and heartily endorse the idea that people undertake a small project first with WPF to start getting a feel for what's in there. And hopefully this presentation will also help you better understand what WPF is capable of. I mentioned, of course, that WPF is mature. We're currently at version 3. Version 1 came with .NET 3.0, version 2 with .NET 3.5, and although it was only a service pack, .NET 3.5 SP1, it actually was effectively the third version of Windows Presentation Foundation. There was a lot of stuff that was baked in SP1 that wasn't there prior. Alright, so let's go and have a demo of WPF. Assuming that you've never actually used WPF before, what would you expect if you were going to sit down after this presentation and create a little demo? Alright, so here we have Visual Studio 2008, and we're going to go through and create a new WPF project. So, File, New Project. Give it a moment, has a bit of a think. And we're targeting .NET 3.5. We're going to build a WPF application too. For the time being, you can ignore the other project types here with user control libraries and browser applications. And we'll just click OK there. Give it a moment to basically create the stub solution for us. It takes a few seconds. All right, there we go. So you'll see by default that Windows Visual Studio 2008 has a split view editor for WPF views for XAML editing. We've got the rich designer there, and we've got the XAML code below. You can, of course, drag in from the toolbox the usual controls that you would expect to see, and put a button on there, and that'll eventually appear. One thing to be aware of when building WPF applications and using the designer like this is that it's very actually difficult to create a robust user interface this way. Now, the reason I say this is because positioning things can be done in so many ways. You can use different panels for the layout. In this case here, we can see that we're setting a margin on this button, which is quite large, and which is placing the button there. We're setting the alignment options. We could have used padding. There's so many different ways of doing it that you tend to want to work with the XAML itself so that you've got the most control. And that tends to be the way that I work. Coming back to what I mentioned earlier about vector-based controls and UI with WPF, you'll see that we have a zoom box up here. Now, I don't use this a heck of a lot myself, but you can see here that we can zoom right in, and for example, the corners on these buttons stay exactly as they should be. They don't become all broken down and jaggedy just because they're stretching an image file. So that's quite nice. However, if we flip that around and we get rid of the designer view, let's have a look at how XAML is generally structured. So you can see here that we're declaring a window using XML. We've got these namespace imports. Now, for a simple case here, you can think of these as using statements or import statements. So if you created, for example, your own user control or something like that, and it was in a different namespace, you would use an XML namespace to import that namespace and give you access to the controls in that namespace. We can then set properties as attributes on this window node, the title, the height, the width, etc. We then have a grid. This is the one of the more basic layout constructs within WPF, and of course we then have our button. It's all very nice, pretty simple. Behind the scenes here, we can see what's going on. It's just a class inheriting off window, That's it. Very simple, very straightforward. You'll notice in our project here that we have an app file and a window one. The app is effectively what bootstraps the application. So if we have a look in the code behind here, here it's off application, and in the XAML file, you'll see here that we have the startup URI attribute being set to window one. So if you were to create another window and wanted that to be the first one to load, this is where you'd set it. Within the application itself, this is a non-visual control or window effectively. Nothing really appears ever, it just passes control to the application primary window. Is that you can put resources inside this application.resources collection that you would like to use at a global level. So, for example, if we had a button style that we wanted to use all throughout the application, we would insert it here. Likewise, if we had a button style that we only wanted to use within Window, we could sit down and we could put it inside this Windows resource collection. So we can go window.resources and put styles in there if we want. We'll have a bit more of a look at styles later. Hopefully that's shown you what to expect when you first create a WPF application using Visual Studio 2008. Let's continue on. Let's talk about data binding. Data binding is an incredibly powerful feature of WPF. In fact, I'd go as far to say that WPF data binding is the cat's pajamas. It's a colloquialism, basically meaning fantastic, very good, happy with it. And if you are having to sit down and effectively write code behind that says things like textbox1.text equals my business object dot name, that's a code smell. Now, code smell is usually something that when you read it, you go, this could be done better. How can I refactor this area? Data binding allows us to declaratively, inside our XAML, effectively bind to business data that we want to display on the user interface. We get data templates. So as you can imagine, if we bind data to, say we bind a user to a user editor control, we don't want it to simply display a toString on that object. We want it to perhaps display something a little bit more detailed, like the first name followed by the last name, and in brackets their age. A data template is a way of saying, all right, I'm going to get this piece of data, and here's the actual template control-wise that I would like you to render WPF. And it affords us massive flexibility, especially in that workflow of having a designer working on things separately, for example. It also means that we don't have too much code behind, and everything tends to just work very nicely. You get type conversion, value coercion. We can walk the tree, for example. You could say, I would like to bind my value to whatever is above me. Keeping in mind we were working with XML, so it's effectively a kind of a nested structure where we could say this button value equals the Windows title value, things like that, and there's a whole lot more to data binding. This whole presentation is meant to be an introduction to using WPF to create next generation user interfaces, so I'm not going to dig too deep into some of these things. It's more of an introduction for you so that you can start playing with this stuff and understanding how you can better build applications using Windows Presentation Foundation. However, let's jump in and have a bit of a demo. Here's a application that I'm going to use to demo here called Quake, and it was created by Ivan Tolson, who's a co-worker of mine at Mindscape, and I think it's a fantastic example of how we can start off with an application that's very, very basic and slowly build it into something more and more impressive. So what I'll do here is I'll just run this up so you can see how it looks. All right, here we go. I'll just resize that a little for us. So we can see here that we've clearly got a list box, and we can see down here the south and east coordinates for what appears to be a quake. It says demo data.quake for each one. That's not really going to tell the end user very much, so it'd be quite nice if we could display more data there. However, we can see that when we click these things, these values are changing. Now, I mentioned earlier that it would be a code smell if we saw code that went, for example, when the list box selection changes, read off the south value and set, south text.txt to that value. So we must be doing something a bit better than that here, surely. So let's go and have a look. Got our familiar structure here, app and window. Give this a moment. All right. So let's just walk through this code and see what's going on. First off, We have our window resources, so these are resources that are available just to this window, and we can see here that we've got a value converter. So what is a value converter? A value converter is helpful in a data binding scenario where we want to say bind a certain value up. In this case, we're going to be binding something that's going to probably be a decimal, but we only want to display a certain number of decimal places. So in this case, we're going to be converting simply to do formatting. However, we could alternatively be binding between two different data types, for example, a bool and a visibility enum. And how do we convert between those two is handled by our converter there. You can see here that we effectively define it as V. V is referencing up here to a namespace. Decimal places limit converter. We provide a parameter to it and we give it a key. So everything within WPF you're effectively storing in a dictionary at the scope. So in this case, the scope level is the window with that key. That has to be unique and it allows us to reference it elsewhere. This is a way of declaratively hooking into code. So if we jump up here and have a look, we have a converters class library, and in here is the decimal places limit converter. This is just a simple class that inherits off iValueConverter, which comes as part of the WPF framework, and you can see it implements two methods, convert and convert back. Cool. Alright, continuing our walk through this class, or this XAML file, we then have the actual user interface. A doc panel, it's just a way of laying out the information, and you can see here that we have a button, so we hit our add random quake button, and then we also have a stack panel that has the south and the text box for the value of south. And you can see here that quite nicely the text equals, and rather than actually being text that we want to display, it's an expression. So text equals a binding to a path south. Now, something to keep in mind if you're new to WPF is that path is effectively synonymous with property. If we were binding to an object, we would be saying that this is the property name called south. But within XAML, we write that as path. You can see here that we provide a converter. Now that converter is referencing show two decimal places. Matches our key, makes sense. One thing that's a little bit odd here is you'll notice that we don't actually say what we're binding to. The same applies down here with our list box, where we have an item source collection that just says binding. We never actually say what we're binding against. There's something really interesting going on here, and that is in the code behind, we're assigning a data context. Now data context actually sits, is provided to us by the window object, but nearly every object within WPF actually has its own data context. And that means that, for example, we could reassign the data context anywhere within our structure of controls. So the data context you can think of is the currently default value just assigned to this control. In this case, it's scoped to the window, and it's just a collection of quakes. That means that our data binding will, by default, have a look at the data context when binding, when we're not providing any other information about what it should bind against. That's why we simply have the expression binding. It will say, you haven't provided me any extra information, therefore, I will just have a look at what's currently in my data context. Okay, quite simple. That's what's going on there. And that's why we can see that we never actually have to say when somebody selects something different in our list box, we don't have to update this text because it's automatically binding against that property. We don't have any other code there. It's all handled for us. Really nice way of reducing the amount of code that we actually have to write in C# or VB. However, I wasn't really happy with the fact that when we ran this up, we were just seeing a list that said demoData.quake. Surely we can improve that. So, let's go and have a look at Quake 2. I'm going to set this as the startup project. I'm going to close these windows here. Just run that up. Okay, cool. So we're getting a bit more data here. This is going to start to become useful to an end user because we can say that, for example, this first quake occurred 38 degrees south, 176 degrees east. It was a 3.1 on the Richter scale, and we've got the date and time that it occurred. Right, that's pretty handy. How did we achieve that with WPF? Well, let's jump in here at our window 1. Okay, so you can see here that we've got a few more things inside our window resources. We've now got two references to decimal places limit converter. That doesn't really matter. The only thing is that in some places we only wanted one decimal place, and in some places we want two. Not really something we want to concern ourselves with. However, this thing is brand new, the data template, and you can see we're assigning it a key, so it's going inside that resource collection at the scope of window. And basically what it's saying is, it just says this data template should insert a stack panel, and it should include these controls here: text block, a whole bunch of text blocks, close the stack panel, and that's pretty much it. You can see in here that we've got our usual binding information going on. We're binding to south, east, magnitude, and time, and that's pretty much it. If we scroll down, we've got exactly the same dock panel that we had before. We've got our list box. The only thing to change down here is that we now assign an item template, and the item template is referencing textual quake display, which you'll recall is the name of our data template. So what's happening here? Well, it's effectively going, what's in the data context? Okay, I've got a collection of quake objects. What should I do with them? Well, rather than just going the object.toString, we should apply this template to it. So it will look this up, see this piece of XAML here, and substitute that in for each list item in the list. And that's going to provide us with a whole lot more information. So as you can see here, we start to get a rather powerful application getting built, because our designer can be doing all of this. In terms of the code that we're writing as developers, we're still working with just a list box item. We don't care how it's actually being displayed. This is a really powerful concept, and something that can take a little bit of time to get used to if you're used to building applications using things like WinForms or ASP.NET. Alright, so that's pretty much the introduction to data binding. Like I mentioned, there's a whole lot more to it, but we could spend the entire session looking at data binding within WPF. So let's move on. Let's talk about controls. So I say here that they're designed to be lookless. What do I mean by that? Well, as you would have seen in the data binding demo, we had data templates, things like that, where we can effectively create bind things together and apply a UI later. The same applies to controls. The controls need to be designed so that as developers we can work with this abstract notion of a list box, but the interface is completely disconnected. It just so happens though that Microsoft, you know, will include the default look and feel of a control when within WPF, but you don't actually need a user interface at all. This is something that can be a bit of a challenge to people who are new to WPF to really kind of get their head around, because you're so used to the visual representation of a control being strongly bound, strongly coupled to the actual code of the control. This is completely not the case with WPF. We could take something like a checkbox control, which would render, of course, as a box with a little tick or cross that appears in it, and we could say, look, we would rather this be rendered as a 3D box that goes in and out of the page like a toggle button. Things like that. We can do whatever we want with that. And hopefully, shortly in demo, I'll give you a good example of that. The current state of controls within WPF, because I know that when you sit down and you want to start building an application, controls are basically what you're going to need as to build your interface. There are many foundational controls, so WPF, to a great extent, has a lot more low-level controls that you don't see in frameworks like WinForms. This is things like a thumb control. Now, thumb control is used, for example, as a resizing thing, something that you're going to click and kind of move around. You can use adorners, things like that. There's a whole lot of the layout controls. Not a heck of a lot of the much higher-level controls. However, they're starting to appear. So this week, Microsoft released their first version of a WPF data grid. There's no data grid control that actually ships with WPF by default. There are some fantastic data grids out there from companies like Exceed that are free to have a play with initially and then buy them as you require. But generally Microsoft's been a little bit slow on pushing out these higher level controls. Next to come out from Microsoft is going to be a ribbon control. These are coming out of band as well. They're pushed up onto CodePlex, so you can get them from there. They're not part of the actual .NET install currently. And this leads to third-party vendors. So companies like Mindscape, where I work, and as I mentioned, Exceed, Infragistics, Telerik, They all build controls that you'll probably need at this kind of earlier stage with WPF if you want to be building line of business applications using some things like, awesome charting and visualization. So that's the current state of where we're at. Styles. So I like to kind of communicate that styles are very similar within WPF as they are to HTML and CSS. More powerful within WPF, but the idea being that you can create your content. So you say, for example, I've got a list box with items, but with the styles, or to use the metaphor, the CSS, you can basically say, this is going to display this way with these values, and that's the way it's going to render. It's a very, very powerful way of building desktop applications. We also have control templates, so that comes back to the lookless comment that I made before. A control template is basically what makes up the visual of this control. For example, a button may be a border with a text block in the middle, but we could replace that completely. We also have triggers. So triggers are ways of creating things like animation, for example. You might say, when the mouse is over this button, we want to change the background. Or, when a certain event occurs within our application, we want this stylistic change to occur to this control. And we're going to have a look at that within our demo here around styles. So without further ado, let's jump in. Okay, so here we are in Microsoft Expression Blend 2. So I'm not going to use Visual Studio 2008 initially for this demo, but we're going to have a look through this tool. Now, Microsoft tried to pitch Expression Blend as being the tool that a designer would use when wanting to create rich user interfaces, and that Visual Studio 2008 would be what the developer uses. To be perfectly frank with you, I find having both tools available is fantastically useful to a developer creating WPF applications, especially to new developers who are new to WPF. I'll give you an example. We're going to create a new project here to show off a control template. Let's call this FooBar2, and we'll click OK. Before we do, you'll notice that we can create WPF control libraries, and Blend also supports Silverlight and Silverlight 2. I've mentioned that throughout this presentation, I'm going to be talking primarily about WPF with some Silverlight at the end. The key thing here is that most of what we're talking about actually works just fine with Silverlight as well. I'm going to cover some of the differences later, so you can apply this to both worlds. Just click OK. We get a design surface up here, and we get our normal kind of project view on the side there. It's not creating it too quickly today, but you can see a very familiar user experience here for Visual Studio developers. We've got our solution file there. That solution in the project file works completely fine between Blend and Visual Studio 2008, meaning that as a designer and a developer can work simultaneously on the same solution. Okay, so we've got a canvas here that we want to work with. I'm just going to resize this. Keep in mind as well that this whole application is written with Windows Presentation Foundation. So let's put a control on here. I'm going to put a button on. I'm going to make a nice big button. All right, very nice. Now, let's say I want to change how this looks. Well, I could go up to the properties view, and I could start altering the way that this button looks just based on what's available now, but that's going to be scoped just to this button. So, for example, I could go and change its color, I could change the text on it, the height, the width. But we want to talk about making changes at a much higher level, say across the application. So if we were to come down here, and actually let's open up another window here. We want to go to the interaction window, and we can start to see a structure here. We've got our window, which has a layout route, which has a button. Now if we right-click on button, we can edit control parts. So what this allows us to do is say that we would like to edit a copy of the current control template. So I mentioned that WPF, of course, ships with default control templates for how all the controls should render by default. This is your standard Windows look and feel. But we want to be able to take that and just start making some tweaks. This is fantastic for people who are new to WPF and who don't necessarily know how to write a complete control template, or you want to say, look, I've got a control template here that's already in use, but I'd just like to make one small change. Basically pull out the existing one so that I can start to tweak it gently. This is something that's not really available within Visual Studio 2008. You can't, click on a control and say, extract me the control template, But as one of the benefits I've found as a developer to having Expression Blend available to me as well. So let's give it a name. We'll call it My Button Style. That's going to, of course, be the key. And you can say where you'd like it to be defined. So we could say that we want to define it in this window, or we could say in the application. If we were wanting the style to apply to everything in the application or be available to it to reference by name, we could just say in the application. Click OK. Okay, I'm going to close this now because we don't need it and we don't have much screen real estate. Okay, so we're now in the app XAML file, and if we change to the XAML view, I might even get rid of this stuff over here as well. You'll see here that we've got our familiar application layout here, but down inside application.resources, we now have this style tag, and we've given it a key, so we could have multiple styles, and we've got button focus visual. That's not the route that we actually want to be working with there. So let's go hunting a little bit. Let's scroll down, scroll down, scroll down. All right, where's it gone? There we go. My button style. Some of these other styles are basically getting referenced using values here. So this is actually the key guy that we want to be working with. So my button style, and we define a target there. So this is again an expression. Even though it says, parentheses X colon type button, that's actually a type that's being passed in there. So let's go and back to our window one. If we look at the XAML here, you'll see that we now have this style being referenced. We say dynamic resource my button style, and because the app is a much broader scope than the window, it can see that the style is available. So it's pulled out everything that's set by default. The background value, the border brush, the foreground, things like that, and you can see here that it's referencing off the system colors for the foreground. Let's say we want to change that. Let's say we wanted it to be blue. All right, and let's just run that up now and see if that's made any changes. So the build succeeded. You can see there that our button text is blue. Okay, that's very nice. Clearly not something that we necessarily needed to make at this level, but it will be applied everywhere. The key here is actually this here. Setter, the property template. So I mentioned control templates, the template to the control, and you can see here that we've got the setter dot value, and when you can't set the value inline, you can set it this way, and we basically want to pass in a block of XAML that's going to be the template for this control. So you can see here we've got this control template tag. And we have our target type again. This is going to work with a button. Now you'll occasionally run into types like this. These are the built-in things that Microsoft have used for creating the kind of Windows look and feel. You can throw that away. There's not a problem with that. We've got a content presenter here. The content presenter is effectively saying, what's the value? I want to show the value here. So in this case, it's just going to be whatever the value is of the button. So for example, text saying click me. And we've then got these triggers. So I've mentioned that triggers allow us to make changes based on certain interactions or events. So the trigger is saying, for example, here, let's look at this one. When the isEnabled property is false, the foreground color should become the systemColor.gray text brush key. All right? So if we wanted to say when this control is disabled, make it green and wobble around, we could do that. You'll notice that we don't actually have to declare the reverse trigger to say that when this is true, we do something else. WPF saves us a bit of typing by saying whatever the initial state is, it will be recorded and know that when this changes, it needs to revert back to that initial state. Okay, so that's all fairly simple. You will find that XAML can get a little verbose at times, and you may look at this and think, gosh, you know what? You said that it's better to write the XAML rather than use the designers, but I can't see that really being that handy. The truth of the matter is that normally you would sit down, you would create a simple style initially, and then you slowly add to it, and before long you've actually created a very large style. But you don't usually sit down and write, say, 500 lines of XAML in one sitting. You create something basic, the next day you may have a request to change something, or you go, I could add a glow to this, that sort of stuff. So it's not really a task that you sit down and have a whole lot of pain with. It's quite amazing sometimes to sit down and reflect on how much Xamarin you've written without feeling like you've had to write much at all. So hopefully that gives you a good introduction to control templates and a little bit on the styling front. Let's go and have a look at another demo here. So I'm just going to close these up. A moment, my computer's not super fast. Now we're going to go back to our Quake example. So let's set Quake 3 as a startup one. Now you'll recall that earlier we had a text list box that just displayed the position of an earthquake, the Richter scale, and the time that it occurred. Now we want to start using styles to make this list box feel far more powerful, look completely different from a list box. Let's run up Quake 3 and see how we're going. Alright, cool. So we're getting a little bit more visual information in here. We're getting the time displayed first in bold, and then we're putting the information about its location and its strength under it. And we've got this circle that's kind of showing as well the strength or magnitude of it. You notice that the font size here is bumped up. Okay. Interestingly, it seems to be in tandem with the fact that the Richter scale level is higher. So the more powerful earthquakes are showing up larger. It's quite a nice way of starting to visualize this information, but it still feels very list boxy to me. Let's go and have a look at how we achieved that outcome. Then Quake 3. Let's jump into our window. All right. This all looks very familiar, our decimal places converter. However, our data template has grown a little. You can see now that we're basically within our stack panel, creating an ellipse, and you'll see here that we're binding the width of that to the magnitude of our earthquake. The same goes to the height. And we then have a little scale factor and that sort of thing in here as well. We're nesting some stack panels, so that allows us to create effectively two rows of information. So we saw that stacked within there. And everything else is pretty much exactly the same. We've still got our text blocks. We're still displaying that in exactly the same manner as before. And down here, we've still got the same dock panel, the same list box. Nothing's actually changed down here at all, other than the fact that we've changed the name of our data template there. It's exactly the same. So from the programmer's point of view, the developer's point of view, it's still just a list box. And this comes back to the point I made earlier about don't be concerned about having to write a lot of XAML. It is normally a case of you would go through and you would write a simple list box, and then later you come through and start adding some simple visualization like this. So it's not really a large task to start out with. I hope that you can all appreciate that this is not a complex thing to actually be sitting down and writing. But let's go and have a look at the next one. How can we make this even better? Let's have a look at Quake 4. Set that as the startup project. Let's close that window. We'll run that up. Now, what you can see here is actually a picture of New Zealand. Okay? And you can see here that we're getting the quakes visually displayed. Okay? Now, this appears to be a large step from just being a simple list box going on. And we're actually getting circles that are larger, much like we had in our previous visualization, where the circle size changes based on the magnitude. And we've also got the opacity level. The ones that have occurred more recently are actually rendering darker. When we selected them, we're getting this kind of orange circle around it. But you can see here that we've left on the list box highlight state so that you know that it is still a list box. We're actually positioning the earthquakes as well, exactly where they occurred in New Zealand. So apparently you wouldn't want to live around this area if you didn't like earthquakes at all. How did we achieve this? Because my point of view is that this is starting to become quite an impressive little application for people that might work with earthquakes to better understand. It's certainly much nicer than a list box of strings. Let's dig in and have a look. Just wait for that to go away. Alright, so we've got a few more converters in here now. We've got a coordinate converter because we clearly need to be able to convert the east and south coordinates into pixel points within our list box area. We've got the age to opacity converter. That's because we wanted the more modern ones to show basically earthquakes that have occurred in the last 10 days more prominently. And we've got our data template here. So again, our ellipse now has a bit more information about it. We're displaying a stroke around it, things like that. If we scroll down, we've got our data template.triggers, and our data trigger this time is a binding. So it's basically binding to the property of isSelected, and I mentioned that we could actually work up the tree to a relative source. So we're saying bind using the findAncestor method, where the ancestor is a list box item. So we know that this data template is going to be rendered within the list box item. So this binding is going to automatically walk up that structure until it finds the item that it belongs to. And if its property isSelected is true, it's going to change some of the properties on the ellipse, for example, that's being displayed. You can see there that we set the radial gradient brushes and things like that. So it's not complicated to sit down and actually write some simple and nice data visualization there. And if we scroll down, we can see here that we've got our doc panel as always. We have had to make some changes to the list box this time because we're rendering a canvas in there. Now a canvas is a simple layout control that effectively says, look, I'm going to give you absolute kind of coordinates here as well. We're effectively just going to set the canvas's background to be a picture of New Zealand that's included in our project. We're not going to tile it, stretch it, anything like that. And then in here, the container item container style, so a list item effectively, what's its style? We're going to be seeing this canvas.left, so WPF is going to know that that relates to this canvas. That its left value is basically going to be the east property, and of course we run that through the converter as well. The same with the south converter there as you'd expect. So not too complicated, fairly straightforward. I don't think it seems too difficult anyway, and we can create quite a nice application. All right, I'll give you one more demo here. Let's jump into this one. Now, I mentioned earlier that I didn't really want to be showing off too much whiz bang kind of graphic stuff, but I thought this was a good case for bringing 3D in here. Let's run this up and see what happens. So I created a simple 3D cube, and it's got a picture of me on it, and at different ages, and one's a cartoon version, and I've basically set it up to spin this cube around for us. Nothing too complicated, but I wanted to mention that WPF has a full 3D architecture to it. You can sit down and write basically pixel shaders, things that are going to execute on the GPU. This is all going to boil down to using your graphics card. WPF effectively sits on top of the same sort of DirectX engine that you would get in gaming, and so we can get fantastic kind of smooth 3D animation here. Anyway, how did I start the animation? Well, I wanted to point out that I'm using an event trigger here, and effectively we call off to this routed event window.loaded. So what we've effectively done is we've started this animation off the window.loaded event, and you can see in here that we have a way of setting up a storyboard. We begin the storyboard, we give it a name, we set up a double animation. So a double animation is basically going to take any property off an object, so we've got an object and a property, and we'd like to take it from a certain value to another. So as you can imagine, most animation is really done by just transforming a property from one value to another and creating event steps in between. And you can see here that we're also saying that we're going to repeat this behavior forever. So that's going to continue moving our cube around. I'm not going to dig too much into how I actually created the 3D stuff here. If you're interested in it, grab the demo code from my blog at the end of this presentation, or have a look around. There's a great book on WPF 3D by Charles Petzold if you're really into the 3D side of things. Great resource for that. Anyway, let's move on. Jump back into the presentation. Right, so commands. So now we're going to be starting to look at some of the infrastructural stuff that sits underneath WPF that's going to make it a better framework for building your applications with over something like WinForms. So a command isn't, as I say here, is an elegant mechanism for application commands. So an application command is something like cut, copy, paste, properties, things like that. And there are a whole lot of these commands built straight into WPF, over 110, 115 or so. However, you can create your own. So you can see down here, we've got a simple snippet of code that's effectively creating a context menu with a command for properties. So when that's selected, it would display the properties for this, for the item that we've brought the context menu up on. Routed events. So I'm going to quickly hammer through a few topics here that are closely related. And routed events, you might be thinking, why do we need an event, you know, when we already have events in the .NET framework? Well, routed events are a WPF-specific event type that provides us with some additional capabilities. We effectively get the idea of bubbling. So that's where we have, for example, a tree structure here. Here we've got a root element that could be the window, parent element that could be the user control, and leaf element could be a button. And we can effectively bubble events up. So we could, for example, within our shell, our window, be looking to capture events that are occurring, like a click event that may occur further down the tree. We can also tunnel back down through this structure if we so desire, which is a more advanced technique. I'm not going to really be talking strongly about how we can create these routed events, but more on the focus on the consuming side. So routed events are just baked into WPF in a lot of places, and as a consumer of those events, there's not really much you have to know about the difference there, but we'll show you a few handy tricks that routed events provide to us as WPF developers. Dependency properties. So again, you think, well, we already have properties in the .NET framework. Why do we need something special? Well, dependency properties are focused on WPF again. You won't find them in any other part of the .NET framework. And they provide us with a whole bunch of additional values, valuable features, like automatic change notification. So you no longer have to implement iNotify property change interface to simply tell things that are bound to properties that they've changed. We get value inheritance, and the reason that we've called them dependency properties is because the value of the property is dependent on many different things around the property. To give you an idea, here's some of the areas that a dependency property can get its value. So I'm not going to talk through every single one, but we could, for example, just have the default value. Could be a value that's inherited, so properties within WPF automatically will inherit values if they're set up that way. So a child of a parent may define a certain property value and it will be inherited into the child below. We get it from style, we've seen triggers. Got local values that could be assigned, data binding of course, animation could be updating it, and coercion where we analyze our value and try and decide on something based on the outcome of that. So let's do a little bit of a demo. Again, these are things that when you're consuming them, like routed events or dependency properties, you won't have to pay that much attention to them. They're not that different to working with normal things, but if you're creating them, there is a few tips and tricks that are beyond the scope of this presentation. So let's go to our command demo. Let's jump to that. I'm just going to run up a simple example first. So here I've created, you know, effectively Notepad 2. I've got a text box and I've got copy and paste buttons. Copy button's disabled and paste is disabled. Well, we expect them to be disabled because copy, we haven't selected anything, and paste is disabled because I don't have any textual content available on my clipboard. If I type something and then I select, copy automatically becomes available. If I click that, paste becomes available. It's automatically undertaking that action as well. I didn't actually have to write any code. Let's go and have a look at how I've built this in practice. Okay, window one. Wait for that to go away. I don't care about the designer. Okay, so I've got a button, and you can see here that I'm just using a built-in application command called copy. The same down here, I've got paste. And you'll see here that I've given a command target. So this is where I've actually said, you know, I only want this command to apply to this main text box. So you'll see this element name. Again, we're using a binding. This is another property that we can use with a binding where it just says, look for an element of this name within our scope. So we can see here that my text box is called main text box. We referenced it there. The interesting thing is if we go and have a look in the code behind, you'll see that I haven't actually written any implementation for these commands. Now this is because they're built in, and WPF automatically understands how to do a copy and paste. So you can see here, this is an incredibly elegant way of writing, a lot of that kind of plumbing code that you would have to create for a normal desktop application without actually having to write much code at all. If you think even further about this, you'll realize that we can create some really impressive applications using application commands. Take, for example, expression blend. Cut, copy, and paste might be on the shell, but we don't necessarily want to be continually probing through everything that's in our application to see can we currently copy, can we currently paste. That becomes a bit of a nightmare in terms of the infrastructure. However, commands underneath it all use routed events. That's that whole bubbling type effect. And we can sit there and basically listen out for things to occur and, react to them. We don't necessarily have to have a command target either. So in the case of a shell where we have cut and paste at the top level, we can sit down and make it so that it says, can I execute? Which can do things like say, okay, if I'm in a text box, do I understand how to copy from that text box? Yes, no. Maybe we can set up a copy so that when we've selected an image, we could perform a copy. That may be a case where you need to write your own command object, but that's fairly simple as well. The key message there is that we don't have to understand what's necessarily sitting within our application from a shell type situation. We can just sit there, bind up to a command, and handle that nicely. All right, let's have a little bit of a look at routed events. So I'm just going to change this here so that we fire up that demo. And I'm just going to show you something that's quite valuable about routed events. So we've got a treeless view here. It fires up. And I've got two types of meals that I like to eat. I like to have a meat mountain, which has a whole lot of different meat meals. I guess I've got some meat with the noodles. And I've got sensible meals, McDonald's and KFC, most sensible of all the meals. However, one thing that I've done here is you'll notice that when I expand a node, I change what's currently been expanded up there. Now, if you think about this, I would have normally had to go through and hook the expand node event on each of the nodes as we created it. All right. What I can do with routed events is I can actually go in and listen at a higher level. So let's have a look what I've done here. Just flip this around. So in this case, I'm not using XAML for hooking the routed event. I've got a tree view with these items, and I've got the text block at the top. In the code behind, what I can do is simply use this add handler method, which is available on most objects, and I can pass in the name of an event, so the expand event on the tree view item. And I create a new routed event handler, which looks like very much like a normal event within .NET, except I've got a routed event args. And I'm just saying that the text of expando collapso effectively should be the header or the string value that's in there. The nice thing about this here is that we haven't had to really crawl down our hierarchy within our tree to find every single tree view item. We're going to get that event bubbled up to us at the highest level, and then we can deal with that. If we wanted to, for example, listen out for these events at a lower level but prevent them going higher, what we can do is we can basically set handle to true, which will stop that bubbling effect at this point, so we don't have to listen out for everything. It's quite a nice and handy thing that to do with WPF. We found this really useful at Mindscape when building components for end users, is occasionally, we want to abstract away some of the complexity there, but somebody may say, "Hey, look, I'd really like to capture this event. Can you make it available?" And the truth is, we don't actually have to do that. Most of the time, you can simply hook the event that's going to occur outside of our control, listen out for it, and deal with it as you would like. Very powerful feature. All right, let's jump back into the presentation. So, whiz bang awesomeness. So, I've shown you today how we can stylize things quite nicely and easily, and I've also talked a little bit about that underlying infrastructure. But what about building a full application? There's an open source application built by Vertigo Software called Family Show. It's on Codeplex, so you can grab the source code and have a play around with it. And it's basically a full end-to-end application for managing family trees, managing your genealogy, that sort of thing. Fantastic resource for people learning WPF. There's even notes on the Vertigo website about what these guys considered when building the application. So design notes, architecture thoughts, everybody was fairly new to WPF at the time, and you might say, how could we do this? We undertook a certain function within WinForms this way. How could we do that with WPF? Things like that. Fantastic resource. Let's have a look. All right, so here's Family Show. I've just run this up. You can see here we've got a dialog. Let's open an existing family tree. Let's open the Windsors, so that's the Queen of England and all of that. Open that up, and we get this really, really beautiful visualization of the family tree. We've got a zoom controller here, so I'll zoom this out a bit so that we can better see the whole tree there. One of the things that's really nice here, I mentioned, of course, that we use vector graphics and vector drawings and that using WPF. This means things like zooming and that can be very smooth. We're not having to stretch bitmaps. We've also got a control over here for the timeline, so we can see, for example, that when we drag this, who was actually alive or didn't exist yet or had passed away based on the timeline. And if we zoom in a bit here, we actually scroll up, you can see when they were born, when they passed away, and how old they were. We even get a really fancy tooltip there showing a picture of them. But if we change this, we can see, for example, how old they were at the time. And you can imagine when looking at this that using data binding here, we could quite ha easily have this all automatically updating. One thing I really want you to take away from this is that when looking at this as a developer and as somebody who's just effectively finished watching this presentation, it should strike you that none of this is particularly difficult to build. For example, you would expect these to just simply be data templates. You would expect, data binding to be used for updating a lot of these values automatically. You could see that application commands probably exist for opening and saving, things like that. Everything is really a primitive thing. It just takes time to sit down and restyle and wire some of this stuff up. But for all we know, this could just be a list box. And the source code's available, so you can go and find out and have a play. Some of the more advanced things with Family Show include the whole reskinning of the application. So if you wanted to build an application where you had skins available, you could totally do that with WPF. And using Family Show would provide you with a great example of how to do that. You've got buttons and all that sort of stuff over here that show you how to put in more information. Grab the source code. I've just got it open here in Visual Studio. It's just two projects there. And have a play around. Have a read of the code. The best way to learn about WPF is both watching presentations like this, but then going out and actually writing some code, maybe dissecting an open source app like this. So do go out and do that right away. All right, let's jump back. I just wanted to show you that there was a full-length demo available that you could have a play with and really get your head around some of the more gnarly things. I think that's important with these sorts of presentations, not to just show really basic little bits and pieces where you can't really see how they would all hang together, but actually show you end-to-end how we could achieve some of these things. So Silverlight 2. So I mentioned earlier on that Silverlight and WPF share a lot in common. XAML's the same, you still use the same tools, you've got the same notion of certain things, like you've got canvas controls and all that. So effectively, a lot of this talk can be simply directly related to Silverlight 2. One thing, however, that I'd like to point out is that, your boss might come to see you at 4:30 on a Friday afternoon and say, "Look, you've built this cool WPF application. I'd really like to see it in Silverlight." And you think to yourself, "Oh, sure, I can totally just port this over to Silverlight. It won't be a big issue at all because it's all XAML, it's all the same, it's all going to work, yay." And then you go, "Oh, wait, bugger. You've just told the boss you'd have it done in an hour," and you start to run into some problems. What sort of problems are you going to run into with Silverlight 2? Well, first off, there's no real triggers there. There is this idea of a visual display manager that, I think it's the Visual Display Manager, that allows you to simulate triggers, but triggers in the direct sense aren't available there. There's also no commanding infrastructure. There's weaker data binding. So what I mean by this is there's still data binding, but there's certain things like multi-binding and stuff like that that doesn't exist within Silverlight 2. There's also a completely different control set. So this is likely to trip you up fairly quickly when trying to port an application from WPF to Silverlight. Again, there are control vendors like Telerik and that have already started releasing Silverlight controls. You'll probably want to look at those. A question I've got when giving this presentation is, what about XBAPs? So an XBAP is effectively a WPF application hosted inside the browser. How does that, correlate to Silverlight? Could we just use XBAPs? Is Silverlight better? Things like that. Well, primarily XBAPs are useful for intranet applications. So you might build a simple time sheeting app within your company and want to put it onto your intranet. That's cool. The reason why you probably don't want to be pushing XBAPs onto the internet in general is because of the differences between Silverlight 2 and XBAPs. Primarily, Silverlight 2 doesn't require the whole .NET Framework 3 at the very least to be installed on the client machine. Silverlight 2 only has a 4.5 megabyte install, and clearly the .NET Framework is much larger than that. Silverlight can run on multiple platforms, so your end user could be using a Mac, or they could be using Windows or anything like that, and it's going to work. XBAPs are going to require Windows. XBAPs consume the whole browser window. Okay, they don't sit within HTML like a control. This means that Silverlight, conversely, does, and it allows Silverlight to manipulate the DOM around it. So XBAPs are a kind of all or nothing scenario. XBAPs, of course, you can run into issues if you build a WPF app and you run it in the browser because you are still constrained by the sandbox mode of the browser. So, for example, you couldn't write an XBAP that then crawls through the registry and deletes a whole lot of keys and run it through the web browser. It's going to be constrained like any other application being run in there. Hopefully that clarifies some of the differences. I'm going to just do a very quick demo of Silverlight 2 because, like I say, a lot of this stuff translates, so we've kind of been seeing demos of both things. So what I've got here is I've got that hasn't rendered quite right. I've got a copy of Blender open. I'm just going to see if I can fix this up. All right, cool. This is now rendering a little bit better. Let's have a look at what we've got here. So we've got a solution with two projects. One is the dig sample. So this is an application that's going to effectively be a Silverlight version of dig.com, a popular website where people can vote up or vote down stories, and the popular ones make it to the homepage. This is a demo that I've taken straight from Scott Guthrie's blog. If you don't read Scott Guthrie's blog, I highly recommend it. He writes some great tutorials and examples of what's new and what's coming out of Microsoft. Definitely go and read that. So the dig sample, we've basically got the application here, and then we've got a simple little project here that's going to allow us to run this up in the browser to test. So I'll show you what the application looks like first. All right, so dig search, we can type in a query. Let's type in Apple. We click search. It's calling off to the services at dig, which is handy because basically we want to see how this is going to work as a mashup. We can see the stories here that are currently being added to dig. One dig basically means it's just been added. We can then bring up more information on the item of interest. So click on that. Level 1 from tracing the iPhone. Okay, cool. So we could then click through and actually read the story as well. We could close this. So coming back to the things we've learned from this presentation, this will be a button with a different style attached. Okay? And we can see that it's a pretty nice little application there that we've written that's running inside the browser. So you see that we've got a familiar structure here. We've got our app.xaml. And if we jump into that, you can see here that we've got familiar structure, application resources. We've got some styles here that are getting applied. It's exactly the same in terms of that structure. We've got a CS file here, so a bit of code. One important thing to note here is that if you double click on a code file within Blend, by default it's going to run up Visual Studio on the machine if it's available, and you'll do the code editing there. We've then got a page, so we can see here that's the part at the top, and we've clearly got space in the lower area there for the results, so you can dig in there. There's not really much to this demonstration because, as I say, we've already run through all of these different things today through this presentation. So if you're comfortable with WPF, picking up and running with Silverlight should not be a big issue. Cool, let's jump on and keep moving with this presentation. So now that you've seen all this stuff, what do you do next? Well, we're going to look at a few tools, the books that you'll find useful, and look at the training. So books, personally, I absolutely love Windows Presentation Foundation Unleashed. It's written by Adam Nathan. This was my absolute bible. Get one for every employee who's having to start off with WPF. Put it on their desk, they're going to find it a great reference. There are some nice little tutorials in there too for building things like a ribbon bar or a Visual Studio styled kind of collapsible UI framework, but on the whole, it's just a fantastic reference. The nice thing about this book as well is all the code and all the images are in full color, so you've got syntax highlighting. Call me a bit of a shallow guy, but that means a lot. It made it a lot easier to read through the code samples. It's cheap as chips. Grab it from Amazon. Fantastic book. There are, of course, other books out there. For example, there's a fantastic book by Chris Sells as well, Programming WPF. There's also, I mentioned earlier, a book by Charles Petzold on WPF 3D, if you're particularly interested in the 3D capabilities of Windows Presentation Foundation. Tools. Clearly, the key ones are Visual Studio 2008 and Expression Blend. If you've got Visual Studio 2005, you probably don't want to use the CIDR beta plugin stuff for WPF. It's not very good in terms of stability. It was a beta. Visual Studio 2008 is the first and currently only version of Visual Studio to have first-class support for WPF. Expression Blend, you're going to need that, as I say, if you're a designer, if you're a developer, you should get it as well. It's a fantastic tool. It's up to version 2.5 beta, I think. You'll need the latest version with the service pack if you're doing some Silverlight 2 work, but you'll find that out on the site. There's heaps of utilities coming out for WPF. This is a list of some of the free ones. There's a profiling tool, which I've got a screenshot of on the side there. This is great for working out why, for example, your application might not be running that well. We can see how the CPU is, what instructions, what's running that's going to be causing spikes in performance, that sort of thing. Snoop is a fantastic desktop utility. You run it up and you can inspect a running WPF application. We've found this especially useful, usually when I mentioned dependency properties getting values from all over the show. Well, you'll find that Snoop will at least give you an indication of where the value's coming from. Maybe it's coming from a parent or a style, that sort of thing. Great when you're trying to debug an application and you're thinking, why is that appearing with a gradient? I don't remember setting that. Where's that coming from? Fantastic tool. Everybody knows about Reflector. It's a great tool in itself. If you jump onto Codeplex and look for Reflector add-ins, you'll find a BAML add-in. That's BAML add-in. Now, what happens is XAML compiles down into BAML form, and by getting this add-in, it's a great way of reflecting, your applications or whatever, and pulling out the styles that other people have used if you wanted to have a look at them. Crack.net, another newish application built by Josh Smith, who's a absolute WPF whiz working at Infragistics, and that's a cool tool for, again, inspecting a running application and seeing what's going on with it. Training and guidance. So clearly there's Tech Ed each year. That's a great event to go to if you're wanting to find out more about WPF. There's events like this, the Unplugged one. There's user groups in your area. There's usually .NET user group mailing lists. There's also videos online like this one. Lots of things available. I'll insert a small plug for us, Mindscape. We clearly build a lot of WPF components and have a fair bit of experience with it. If you've got a new project you're starting and you're wanting somebody to come and review it for you, find out more information, give us a call, we'll help you out. So the future. So clearly we're just starting to see the tip of richer visualization. We can see that WPF allows us to create richer visualizations nice and easily. That's fantastic. It's only going to become more and more prevalent as people are starting to see that creating more and more richer applications leads usually to more sales, people understand things quicker. That whole full circle that I mentioned earlier about HCI and user experience does pay dividends. And of course, we've got touch computing coming. So Windows 7 has a strong touch computing capability. Microsoft is committed to building touch capabilities into WPF. And while this may not appeal initially to a lot of B2B development, if you're building applications that go to consumers or you're building applications in, say, arts and media industries, for those sorts of businesses, you're going to want to be paying a little bit of attention to touch computing down the road as well. So for those of you who are interested in Expression Blend, you can grab it as part of your MSDN Premium subscription, or you can purchase it online for $186. I assume that's New Zealand dollars for anybody who's watching this overseas. You can grab it at Microsoft.com/expression. And this is what's coming up for the next Unplugged in December. Right, these are the dates. Can't recall what they're talking about, but jump onto the website at the bottom there, and you'll surely be able to find out. Thank you very much for taking the time to watch this presentation. I hope it's given you a good, solid introduction to WPF and how you can start going about building some of these richer applications and user interfaces using the capabilities provided by WPF. If you have any questions, please do email me at jd@mindscape.co.nz. Always happy to answer a query. Thank you very much.